Before we get to the show, brief announcement. Our new book, Death by Umbrella, The 100 Weirdest Horror Movie Weapons, is out. It's great, but don't take our word for it. Bookgasm said it was fun and funny, lovingly written with verve for the viscera. Couldn't have said it any better ourselves. We're flattered. Anyway, help support the show by picking up a copy. Thanks a lot.
Top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind a Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? It's not fair. Throw it away. All right? All right!
They're coming! The rats are coming! Thousands of them!
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord! It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Hey, wait! There's something weird here.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family. Dangerous Men.
Yeah, let's let this maddening riff play for another minute or two, and then we'll begin. And if you think that's catchy,
it is.
But when you hear for about 10 minutes ad nauseum, it gets a little bit ridiculous, I would say.
Yeah, the recurring motif through Dangerous Minds, or no,
Dangerous
sorry,
Men.
Dangerous Men. My God, Michelle Pfeiffer, we hardly knew you.
Michelle Pfeiffer?
Dangerous Minds.
Oh, yes. I thought you were talking about Beautiful Mind.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
See, this movie has turned our minds to mush, therefore.
This is true.
Yeah.
This is the brainchild, speaking of Beautiful Minds, of John S. Rad.
Yes. This would be Iranian director John S. Rad, a.k.a., forgive my pronunciation, Jahangir Salehi Yeginrad.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good to me.
Yeah. And Mr. Rad, this man came to America
with
like
a
all
dream.
Immigrants. Mm-hmm. With a dream.
Yep.
And in 1979, he began production on this movie, Dangerous Men, only to see it completed and released in 2005, 26 years later. And it's recently been released for the world to enjoy.
Yeah.
In pristine Blu-ray, courtesy of Alamo Drafthouse. I got to thank Clint Wheeler from MVD Entertainment for providing us with this copy to watch, to enjoy, to discuss And yeah, man, Dangerous Men. This is up there. This is one of those, like, so bad it's, I don't know what to say. 26 years in the making for this this thing. This is like, you know, from your Miami Connections, your Samurai Cops, yeah, your Birdemics, your Rooms. Dangerous Men fits the bill quite nicely.
Just think what Def Leppard could do in 26 years. They could record maybe two albums. Just think what, yeah, but yeah, Dangerous.
Yeah, that was about the time for Appetite for Destruction to Chinese Democracy. Yes. That was 26 years, so yeah. Great art takes
Take
time.
That, Axl Rose. Yeah, yeah, this yeah. is true. Where to begin? One of the few movies, along with Birdemic, that's arguably recorded worse than this very podcast. Again, ADR mixed with on-site sound, mixed with the sound of the surf, occasionally drowning out the actors, which are occasionally drowned out by what we were previously listening to for at least, 10 to 15 minutes.
MOS live sound with God knows what. Lots of the same synth motifs going through and through and through. And that's just the audio qualities of this movie, but the visual qualities are even more egregious. But beyond that, the story, I mean, this is a movie that in 80 minutes manages to compact three separate story arcs to the point that at the end of the movie, you're left with three characters that you barely met at the beginning.
in the preceding 60 minutes. Yeah.
It's beyond belief. I mean, so when this movie begins, one thing that is hilarious is that every credit is John Rad. Mm-hmm. So we have written by John Rad, produced by John Rad, directed by John Rad, music composed by John Rad. I almost expect to see craft services by John Rad.
Yeah. Best boy, the grip, and the gaffer, and the candlestick maker.
And that's it. It's all John Rad. So, I mean, love it or hate it, this is this man's vision. And what a vision it is. Because after 5 minutes of that maddening synth riff... we meet what we expect to be a protagonist, but are they really a protagonist?
Not really.
In the world of Dangerous Men, anybody can be a protagonist, really.
This is true. Yeah. We had at least six or seven protagonists at any one time.
Right. We have these brothers, Daniel and David. Daniel is a cop, and David is a... I don't know what he is. They don't really say.
And they look a lot alike to compound problems. Yeah.
David is, he's engaged to be married. He's got a lovely fiancée by the name of Nina. And he goes to great pains to ask Nina's father, who basically looks to be about the
looks about 10 years older than the couple. And he asks for his permission for his daughter's hand in marriage. And they look like all three of them are contemporaries.
Right. And then we have this scene of Nina and David, and they're professing their love for each other. And every line of dialogue is overshadowed by this maddening, like, wind or static or what have you. Mm-hmm. Again, this movie...
What we were arguing about it is, obviously there's nothing else to pay attention to, whether they were on a rooftop patio and whether the wind was cutting in and out or whether what was behind them was just green
glass.
Screen.
I don't know where they were.
So many questions. We'll be able to address at least the bulk of them here.
But the reality is that, again, this movie was a 26-year production. So, ultimately, when we see when David asks for Nina's hand in marriage, they then take a leisurely drive down to the beach. And you could see on David's windshield an oil change sticker, which clearly has the date 1984 on it.
Yes.
1984. Now, that's very important to remember that, because later on, we see a calendar in a quote-unquote police station office with the year 1995.
Yes.
So, I mean, this movie, it spans decades. Mm-hmm. It spans generations. It's unbelievable. It's, like I said...
It's a sweeping epic.
It is a sweeping epic. Forget The Godfather.
Out of Africa, yeah.
This is the dangerous...
Forget The English Patient. Yeah, this is your sweeping epic.
Okay. The plot is very, very... all over the place. But I guess we can start to sort of extrapolate a little bit of this plot. So we have Nina and David, and they're on the beach, and they're having a lovely time. And there's these two bikers who actually look like bikers.
Yeah.
Give it to John Rad for hiring actually
menacing,
bald-headed, tough. They look like they are, their tattoos are fake as shit, but they look like bikers. And as soon as they see Nina, they're like, "Oh yeah, we want some of that." So, as Nina and David are frolicking on the beach, these bikers are hovering ever so
menacingly, to pounce. And they make the arrangement that one will go after the guy, while the bald one will make it with the woman, and then the bald-headed guy charitably said he would switch, so the other guy could have his sloppy seconds, or was it, as it were. So they're going to go attack these two. They go after them, but this guy can handle himself.
This being David.
Don't let his wimpy, ridiculous exterior fool you, and his shaved down completely sideburns. Looks like he's going to get the better of these two guys, but...
But you got to remember, though, as he's getting his shots, the bald-headed goon is carrying off Nina like the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Or King Kong.
God knows what with her. And exactly.
He raises her to the other side of the beach.
And it looks like he's going to maybe, prevail, but then the bald-headed goon comes back. And, yes, he killed that one biker. The bald-headed goon proceeds to pull out a knife and stab poor David in the stomach.
Yeah, so much for our assumed protagonist at the beginning.
So much for the Ballad of Nina and David.
Yeah, it's a short ditty,
So, this leads to, the soundtrack for this movie is just completely hilarious. And, we go from this maddening synth motif to, like, this saccharine number. Goodbye, my love. Goodbye. Goodbye, my love. Goodbye.
It's like the surf coming in and out.
Yeah. Well, that's later. Yeah. That's the first song there. Yeah. So Nina, you would think that she would be distraught of the loss of her fiance. And she sort of is. But right away, she just goes up to the biker and says, "I'm free. Mm-hmm. Let's go."
Yeah.
And they go to this motel.
Yeah.
The seedy motel. Looks like it's LA Sunset Strip, perhaps. Mm-hmm. I don't know. And,
She tells the biker, "Jesus, you did me a favor. I never cared for this Nebbish. He was terrible, and you extricated me from this lousy situation."
So never mind
they
the fact.
They hang off.
Never mind the fact that the biker's, as he says, only friend is now lying dead on the beach asphyxiation. Yeah. Nina's fiance is lying dead on the beach from stab wounds to his stomach. They go off to this motel. Now, fortuitously for Nina, the biker's a bit hungry. Mm-hmm. And he asks if they have a restaurant in the motel. And they do. So, they order some steak. And Nina, clever bitch as she is, takes her steak and she does, but purposely knocks it off the table. Next thing you know, the biker and Nina are in the room. And Nina has some very, very, very specific instructions for her
vis-a-vis their forthcoming lovemaking.
Yes.
Very, very specific.
"I am going to get undressed, and then you're going to lick my knees, and then my belly button." And then she repeats it. "First my knees, and then my belly button."
Yeah.
And as this 280-pound bald-headed goon is licking her belly button, the camera pans on Nina's buttocks, and clenched within is a steak knife, which she dropped on the floor of the restaurant, which she then proceeds to take out and stab the ever-loving shit out of this biker.
Yeah, well, topless. An amazing scene. You can definitely say that was unprecedented in cinema history. Unless you have some reference, you're going to pull out of your ass to encounter that. But holy crap, I did not see that coming. And, the whole thing you cannot see coming as a set piece. Like, these two murdered their significant sort of others, although this one is his friend and it's her lover. They both die at cross purposes there. They end up hooking up. She kills him. That whole sequence I did not see coming. Yeah. That was really quite baffling, and I'm still trying to wrap my head around it.
Now, the other thing about Nina, Nina is, next thing we know, she's running down some, deserted stretch of highway in some what looks like a desert. Meanwhile, this motel was...
Who knows where this was,
urban area. Yeah. But what I was going to say is that, Nina, I'm not trying to disparage people's looks or anything like that. She's not terrible on the eyes, mm-hmm. but he's no perfect 10.
No.
But yet every man in this movie...
is just completely smitten with her. But
not smitten with her. Every man wants to rape her. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. You know, sexual assault is nothing to be taken lightly. But when every man in this movie is a rapist, I mean, there's something a little bit kind of off-kilter about that. Mm. So before we know it, we have Nina trying to escape this motel, and she flags down a passing motorist who looks to be just a run-of-the-mill, suited family man. And he picks her up. And Nina, ever so fatigued from her previous bout of
ordeal,
murder,
yeah.
She falls asleep. And this, describe this man, Chris, this man that picked her up.
Oh, jeez. He looks like the Greek patriarch from, like, Days of Our Lives or something. He's got one of these, I don't know, like a salty mustache and tussled hair. He's an old family man with a suit and tie, and mm-hmm. but don't let that facade fool you. He's armed.
Well, he's got a gun in his car, and he looks at me and he goes, "Why should I pass up this opportunity? She's God's gift to a henpecked husband." Yeah. All of a sudden,
transition into what he's going to attempt to do to her. Yeah,
they're pulled over. He's got his gun out. He's ready to sexually assault her. Mm-hmm. Nina is sort of crafty.
Yeah, she's street smart. She says, "Oh, well, before we get involved, why don't you take off your clothes mm-hmm. and put the gun away? That's not really my scene." He doffs his clothes down to his tighty whities, one of the numerous pair of tighty whities we see mm-hmm. in this movie. She grabs a knife.
And grabs his cock.
Yes.
Yeah. And you could totally see her grabbing
yeah,
that thing.
Yeah.
All 5.5 inches. Yeah. She's got that knife and she's got that gun. And she then tells him to exit the car and doff his tighty whities.
Yes.
And she drives off. Which leads us to this very inexplicable interlude with this man who, like, we have no investment in him whatsoever.
Yeah, and he has this monologue. And a soliloquy about his predicament
yeah.
as he's running through the brush, naked, covering himself like Adam, and talking about, oh, his family and what's going to happen to him, what is he going to do? He sounds like Michael Palin from Monty Python, and you would never get this out of his character when we first meet him. You would mm-hmm. never think he would be so goofy. Yeah. And why you would be so invested in a rapist for at least, I gotta say, 7 or 8 minutes as he's wandering through the California brush, naked, trying to flag down a motorist to get him help. Like, why? Why was this so protracted? What point did this serve?
Why? What's the significance? I don't know. More germane to the plot is the fact that Nina is now taking it upon herself to become this sort of avenging angel. Mm-hmm. And she now wants, she's going to devote her life to ridding the world of all the men and scumbags, mm-hmm. yeah. And she picks up a lady of the evening. And they go back to another motel. The lady of the evening proceeds to doff her top. Nina says, hey, what are you doing? Stop that. I just want to talk with you. I want to learn all about your business. I want to learn.
Yeah, learn the lay of the land for laying customers and johns and figure out what is up with her lifestyle. Because she wants to lure men to their
indeed.
Demise.
I mean,
yeah.
This could be like Avenging Angel. I mean, there's actually a movie that was called that where, you know,
okay.
I haven't seen it, but from what I recall, it was a Corman production where there was a young girl who was a student by day, prostitute by night, and she was out there trying to avenge, what have you. I don't know. I haven't seen the film. So, I mean, this film could have easily taken that detour where Nina is out there on the streets picking up Johns and dispatching of them. And she was doing a lot of that. But the movie then sort of shifts gear. We go from Nina, and I mean, you know, this is not going without attention from the local police department. Yeah. Someone's out there, you know, murdering men willy-nilly. And Nina's erstwhile brother-in-law, Daniel, who is on the force, is assigned to
this case, yeah.
To this case. And now we're sort of like in the second act of Dangerous Men. And this is the story of Daniel trying to track down these bikers, Nina, and what have you.
Now this takes him to a tough guy bar, which is populated by these bikers. Mm-hmm. And
the same bald-headed goon is there.
Yes. And the bartender is familiar with his clientele, and he tells him that these guys frequent this place with regularity, and tells him that the deceased's son is the kingpin of this particular gang, and has killed, as we wrote down both in our notes, more men than none.
Yeah.
And he goes by the moniker Black Pepper.
Black Pepper. A very fitting moniker for example, somebody in a blaxploitation movie.
Yes, yes.
Not for this character.
Yeah, and we'll discuss that soon.
Yes, right. So on the trail of Black Pepper.
Yeah, and in the same bar, there's a vixen who's by herself playing darts, mm-hmm. and every two-bit third-rate member of the criminal element in this place is completely taken with her, one of whom more so than all the others, and that happens to be the bald guy whose partner was killed in that beach melee.
Yeah.
He goes, chases her out of the bar. She makes her way to the beach.
Which looks like the exact same beach
yeah.
where his partner was killed all those years
yeah,
ago.
Yeah, this is very true.
And he goes from wearing some sort of like sundress to this sort of thong bikini.
Yeah.
And he goes in, grabs her.
Yeah, again, grabs her from the surf.
Like the creature from the Black Lagoon. And he attempts to rape her.
Meanwhile, David is in tow. Because mm-hmm. he's kept an eye on this guy. He knows this guy's up to no good. He follows him down to the beach. Pounces on him while he's attacking this woman. Twists his neck. Leaves him for dead. And this is where we both wrote down. This is just hilarious. Where they used beef footage of the vixen. Because she was in the surf and wet, completely swimming, and then the next moment her hair is completely dry and she's back in the sundress, as if the first thing she did after being attacked was go through an instant hair dryer and put her sundress right on and just stand there like just as a passive bystander watching him take yeah. out this guy and like crank his neck.
Ostensibly, you know, you're watching this movie and you're thinking, I mean, again, like this is a 26-year endeavor, so things are changing all the time. Like
yes.
Film stock is changing.
Yes.
Hairstyles are changing. The
models
are changing.
Of cars are changing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's lots
and
going on.
You're thinking, okay, well, I mean, you know, I'm invested in Nina. What's going to happen with Nina? Fuck Nina.
Nina is never to be seen again.
Because now we're onto the story of George and Black Pepper. Where Black Pepper fits into this, I have no idea.
He's just another goon.
Nor his sister-in-law being out there being this sort of avenging angel. He's just some weird motorcycle tough who now becomes priority numero uno.
Yes.
Where David now has to go after Black Pepper.
Yes.
Ultimately finding himself at Black Pepper's compound. And I gotta say, before we talk about Black Pepper, let's talk a little bit about the sex scenes in this movie.
The word that springs to mind is very unflattering.
Okay.
Or the other tack would be that it celebrates different body types, because what it shows are women in various states of undress, with scars, with cellulite, with guts, with veins, with everything, every imperfection. So take your pick, a little column A, a little from column
right,
B.
Right.
It's, yeah, not flattering to the female form and
maybe
to the male form.
Yeah.
Just not appealing angles.
Yeah. So this now, all of a sudden, inexplicably, we're now in this whole, like, pursuit of Black Pepper. Now, when I hear the name Black Pepper, I'm thinking, like, maybe some Isaac Hayes type
character. Yeah, Fred Williamson or something.
Right.
Yeah.
This is not what we get in this movie.
No. Much melanin removed from that.
Yeah. Indeed. This guy's pretty much virtually an albino. He's
yeah,
like,
yeah.
98-pound doppelganger of, like, you know, Tommy Shaw from, like, Styx or something.
Yeah,
you know?
or the singer from Poison or something, for sure.
Just
ridiculous. We both made the same joke earlier. It was like, he should have been called White Pepper.
Yeah.
There's I don't know how he came by this nom de plume, but anyway, he is suddenly the chief antagonist when he was only mentioned in passing, and then all of a sudden, he's the key to everything. And why? We
Never
don't know.
Never mind. The protagonist goes from Nina to David to this police chief who we barely meet. I mean, when this movie ends, okay?
Yeah, it's like a Barney Miller kind of character. He just appears, and mm-hmm. he leads the entire investigation, although we have nothing invested in him.
And so when this movie ends, I mean, David is ostensibly taken out of Black Pepper. Still alive, but he's done for.
Mm.
And the movie ends with three characters who we have had absolutely nothing invested in for the entire movie, other than, you know, perfunctory, like, ridiculousness, and that being the police chief, Black Pepper, and a blind lady who was a seamstress.
an armed seamstress who, despite her physical impairment, is not a bad shot. She gets off a couple shots, I think, at Mr. Brett Michaels there, and barely misses him. And she's pretty good, although he gets the better of her, but just to save them in the nick of time is the chief. And then it cuts to credits, and it's mid-cuffing of this goon. And one arm is tied behind his back, and the other is mid-cuff. Her leg is one leg up on the seat, and it just ends. And there's nothing, and as he said, there's no... This woman is introduced like the one of the friends from Tommy Wiseau's The Room. She appears... Who is she? We don't know. We don't know what happens anymore with David.
Right.
Like, what went on?
We barely know what happened to Nina. If I can describe this movie in one word, besides motherfuckingly entertaining, is disjointed. This is a disjointed film. And I mean, it stands to reason. When you're filming a movie over 26 years, you're going to have a little bit of disjointedness. Kudos to John Rad for sticking with his vision for that long. Mm-hmm. And putting out, you know, this piece of celluloid. I mean, the one thing I did not mention, although I alluded to it earlier, is this one scene. One scene where Nina is, after killing God knows how many people, is ever so pensively singing on the beach. And there's a song on the soundtrack set to a sort of like Persian Farsi sort of beat. And the lyrics are, "My love, splendor of the moment." And as this song is singing on the soundtrack,
the tide lyrics comes in
and, are written in the sand on the surf, and then the tide comes in, washes away the lyrics. She's holding a seashell. She flashes back to giving a gift to Daniel.
To Daniel,
which was comprised of some seashells that she found. She made
some hideous seashell art. It wouldn't pass muster in grade 4 art class.
Not even outside of art. This thing was fucking hideous.
Yeah, worse than any glued together macaroni from elementary school.
Yeah. This movie is completely, completely disjointed. It's completely off the rails. It, every time you think you got a handle on it, you know where it's going, it veers somewhere else, and you're like, okay, well, now I'm watching a different movie. This is a three-act film in 80 minutes.
Yeah.
It's quite spectacular for that reason.
Yeah, and the chief protagonist, beaten and left for dead and never seen again, and it's never questioned why that is. And he shares screen time, probably not altogether different, with a family man rapist wandering through the California desert looking for a good Samaritan to help him out. Like, so he shares, like, and the chief antagonist we only meet at the 60-minute mark, who is only very tangentially related to most of the people here, who has nothing to do with the demise of Daniel. Right. And he becomes the MacGuffin after which the whole plot follows.
Like, and for those 20 minutes that we do meet Black Pepper, we have to watch him enjoy a belly dancing demonstration.
Yeah.
Some really kind of hideous woman doing some belly dancing.
Yeah.
We get to watch him in a sex scene.
Yes.
And John S. Rad has something to do. He's got some sort of knee fetish. Just every fucking sex scene, there's some sort of knee caressing in this movie.
Yeah.
So, well, I mean,
maybe when the Ayatollah came to power in Iran, they cracked down on skirts that went past the above the knee. I'm only guessing. I can't get into the mind of John S. Rad.
No, nor can we ever, because unfortunately the poor man passed away in, I believe, 2013.
Mm-hmm. So he failed to see his nearly three-decade, five-president encompassing vision come to screen be successful. It did screen
like a handful of people. LA, yeah. Mm-hmm. And urban legend goes that 7 people paid to see that, although that's been debunked on the Blu-ray extras, where they said it was more like 70 people paid to see it. But in a one-week run, a 22nd-year labor law opus, only 70 people paid to see it? That's still sort of sad. Now,
fewer than 2 people per year.
Yeah. the reality is, this movie is incomprehensible. This movie is pretty amateurish, but at the same time, it's fucking entertaining. And I've got to commend the filmmakers of this world that are akin to John S. Rad. Those people that are so committed to their art, the hell or high water, they will do whatever it takes. Temporal distance be damned. Budgetary limitations be damned. Plot comprehensibility be damned. I mean, it's just, there's something so unique about these fringe filmmakers that just want to make what they think is going to be their grand statement, you know? And unfortunately, it's a shame that Jonas Rad is no longer with us, because I would love to see what else this man is capable of doing. Mm-hmm. If he needed 26 years to make this...
Imagine what he could do in 56 years.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Give him another 50 years, and God knows what the hell was going to come out of that. Dangerous Men 2, even more dangerous.
Yeah.
ultimately, this movie, I mean, it's an utter failure on every level, but you know what? Objectively, yes, it is a failure, but in our books, it's pretty fun.
It's pretty damn fun.
So what did you learn from Dangerous Men, Chris?
I learned that the belly dancer... It was credited in the closing credits as Ruhi, and actually got billing in this thing, and she, we don't want to be uncharitable, unkind. She's bloody hideous to look at, and Black Pepper was, I guess, doing this as an adjunct to his romancing of his girlfriend. His girlfriend, we were both remarking, she had forearms like a baseball slugger, and again, like this veins popping out, and the just I guess you got to credit those involved, because it takes a certain amount of confidence to be exposed in not flattering states. It really does remind me of Greg Sestero's, you know, love interest in The Room, where her jugular is throbbing in that red dress.
Yeah, it really is goiter. Yeah,
yeah, and it's so unflattering. And even in the first scene when Daniel is making love with his paramour there, again, you see the cellulite and an unflattering shot up her skirt in the hotel room, or where it was they were, I don't remember. It's unflattering in the extreme to everyone involved. And the men don't get off easy either, because they do not look sharp either. No one looks good in their tighty-whities.
Well,
it's
go,
just
man.
Really unpleasant to look at. There's lots of unpleasant nudity.
Now you're stuck in what I learned. And what I learned is that from the period of 1979 to 2005, nobody in the Los Angeles area had ever heard of boxer briefs. Every would-be rapist in this movie is wearing a pair of tighty-whities. I mean... God damn, man. Like, Fruit of the Loom was doing a booming business, because, I mean, it's all tighty-whities, man.
Not one banana hammock, either. The very uniform undergarments in this film. My God. And, another thing I learned is I was made queasy by several of the dolly, or maybe they didn't have a dolly. Some of the tracking shots made me a little bit physically ill. So, but again, labor of love. Lots of years went into this thing. Who could hire a line producer for... 3 decades to follow the various, you know, transgressions that ended up on film. Yeah. It was impossible. So good on them. This thing is really interesting.
Can you imagine that, though? It's like, okay, I'm going to make a film, and I'd like, you know, I'd like your commitment. I'd like to sign it online, and I need you for the next 3 decades. Hence, are you going to be available for that period of time?
Hey, I might be. Yeah, to see this through, and we both referenced Neil Breen and these people who have something in mind, and they want to get it to they want to get their vision out there. And this is neat stuff. And we're going to go to our star rating now.
Yeah.
And like, I would say a solid 3.25, 3 for me, which is between 3 and 5. Honest recommendation. You have to see this thing.
Yeah.
Some really good fist flying too, and some strong chins able to absorb countless right and left crosses. So some really good fight scenes, some pretty good soundtrack, I gotta say, although let's say a little overused, but a pretty good riff, a combination of George Clinton and Beastie Boys. Some cool stuff.
Well, if only to see an emaciated albino given the moniker Black Pepper. I mean, this movie is worth at least 3 stars.
Oh, and for sure. And I mean, a steak knife concealed in the buttocks is anything.
Yes,
really amazing.
So, I mean, objectively, this... You gotta look, objectively as a movie, I mean, this thing is like a half a star.
Yeah.
But on a
stuff, you know, you've never seen before.
Stuff you maybe thought you'd never want to see, but you need to see. Yeah, I'm going to give this a 3, 3.5. It doesn't quite have the joy de vivre, like, let's say, Miami Connection. I mean, that movie is so infectious and incredible. It doesn't quite reach the what the fuck of Get Even, a.k.a. Road to Revenge. Those are your 4, 4.5 star bad movies. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely worth seeing, and I'm going to give this one a solid 3.25 stars.
Yeah.
So, Dangerous Men, it's
dangerous.
Quite dangerous. Quite worthwhile. For more, check out our relatively non-dangerous website.
Yes, it's a fairly innocuous website. Yeah. www.reallyawfulmovies.com, and follow us on Twitter, awful_movies, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.